Now listen to them. You're with us for an hour of birds here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. That was the Baltimore Oriole, thanks to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Flaming orange body, a black head. Have you seen any yet this spring? I caught a glimpse of two Baltimore Orioles as I walked through Owen Conservation Park over the weekend. What birds are you seeing in your backyard? Bird lovers, we want to hear from you this hour. What's your favorite bird you've ever seen or heard? Was it from a faraway place like Australia or Costa Rica? Or was it right in your own backyard? We're at 800-642-1234. Jennifer Ackerman has been writing about science and nature for decades. She looks at how birds use intelligence and ingenuity in their daily activities. Her new book is called The Bird Way, a new look at how birds talk, work, play, parent, and think. Jennifer, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, COVID-19 is really clouding every aspect of our life, and that's probably true also in the animal kingdom. How has the recent slowdown of our human activities, our quarantines, how has that changed the bird world?
Well, you know, it's not clear. The data is not in yet, but I would say just from observations that I think we're experiencing more, you know, boisterous bird activity, and you know, birds seem. I wake up every morning to the dawn song, and I swear that it just sounds more. That birds sound more numerous and active than ever. But the question is whether, you know, some of the normal noise that we hear, the roar of highways and jets, those things are much toned down. So now we're actually, you know, able to hear the birds more. And also, I think we're paying more attention to birds. And so that, you know, that we really are noticing what's going on in our backyards.
And you're connected with ornithologists all over the world who work in the field. Have you heard how they're doing at all, or how people in your community in ornithology are doing?
Yeah, it's a rough time in many ways, because everybody, if you work in the field, you know, with a team of researchers, you're really hampered by the effects of COVID. But I think that many of the ornithologists I know are also turning to, you know, just observations in the nearby areas and really taking note of things that they hadn't noticed before. I have a friend who's an ecologist at Griffith University in Brisbane, Australia, and he specializes in the interactions between humans and wildlife, and he told me that he really does think that the lack of people is being noticed by the wildlife in you know, a lot of places. Birds are thriving because there's this dip in noise and light and air pollution, and all the parks and public gardens are emptying out. And he noticed that at his campus, there was a pair of glossy black cockatoos that had taken up residence on campus, and they're very rare birds. So he was delighted to find these rare birds in his backyard.
Wow. We're talking with Jennifer Ackerman, a science writer. Her new book is called The Bird Way, talking about birds all hour long. Are you seeing some rare birds you haven't seen before? And maybe you start your day by looking out your window. What birds are you seeing? What's migrated into your vicinity, your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jennifer, I was making rice last night, and I picked up one kernel of rice, and I showed it to my kids, and I said, "This is the size of a Rufus hummingbird brain." And they said, "No." Is that true, a size of a grain of rice in a hummingbird?
Yes. I think the Rufus hummingbird is an amazing bird. All hummingbirds are, but this bird, with this brain the size of a grain of rice, can recall not only the location of a particular flower it has fed on in a vast field of flowers, but it can remember when it fed on that particular flower and return to it only after the flower has had time to replenish its nectar. So this hummingbird stores that where and when information about hundreds of flowers in a brain, yes, only about the size of a grain of rice.
How is that possible?
Well, you know, we used to think that the brains of birds were so small and primitive that they were really, you know, capable of only the simplest mental processes. But now we understand that a bird's brain is actually a kind of miracle of miniaturization. It's dense with neurons, it's highly efficient, and it's really capable of astonishing mental feats.
You know, the biologist E.O. Wilson had said that when you've seen one bird, you have not seen them all. Birds are incredibly diverse. Help us understand the range of even sizes and, you know, from the smallest birds in the world to some of the larger ones.
Yeah, this is one of the stunning things. Diversity in the bird world is just mind-boggling, and it, you know, its size, its plumage, its physiological capacity. Birds can go to such extremes, and then it's also behavior. So in size, you have, you know, you have birds ranging from the bee hummingbird, which is the smallest bird on the planet, to birds like ostriches and emus, you know, these enormous ground birds. And the physiological extremes, you have birds that can dive, like the emperor penguin, which can dive on a single breath for 27 minutes. Mm. You have birds like barheaded geese that can fly through the Himalayas in incredibly thin air. And, you know, and flying is a very demanding activity, but these birds can manage it at extreme altitudes and for long periods of time.
Let's take a call now. Jeremy is joining us from Fairchild this morning. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello.
What bird did you see?
This was a few days ago. I don't know if it's the right name for it, but I've never seen this bird ever in Wisconsin. I looked it up, and they say it's a snipe with a very long beak.
A very long beak. So where did you see it? What was it doing?
It was just, you know, it was walking across my driveway, and it was kind of rocking back and forth, and it was just slowly rocking back and forth and walking at the same time going through, you know, the taller grass. And the beak was like maybe 8 inches long. It was huge. I'd never seen it before.
Jennifer, what was Jeremy seeing, do you think?
Well, it could have been a snipe. I mean, one of the amazing things about, and I don't know whether you all had a recent storm, but a lot of times storms bring in birds that are very unusual for the area. And, you know, they're called vagrants, and everybody rushes to see them. And, you know, I think one of the astonishing things about birds is that they do stay on course for their migrations generally. They get, you know, they occasionally get blown off course, but then they can find their way back onto their usual migratory path, you know, within hours. So if a bird, an unusual bird, shows up in your yard or your driveway, best run out and see it right away and call all your friends, because it will be gone and on its way in a short period of time.
Taking just a stop over, Jennifer Ackerman is our guide to all of these beautiful birds. Her new book is called The Bird Way. What do you wonder about how birds communicate and how they mate and parent, how they experience the world? We have a bird expert with us taking your questions at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Jennifer Ackerman here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're all about birds on the morning show. That was a red-winged blackbird from the Cornell Lab. These blackbirds returned to our state late February, early March. They love our wetlands, and we're exploring the important parts of a bird's life, unlocking mysteries of their world with your questions. Have you been paying more attention to birds outside your window since the Safer at Home order? What have you noticed that you didn't notice in the past? Have you seen any surprising bird behavior or any stopovers in your driveway? Any beautiful songs, striking cries? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have author Jennifer Ackerman taking us around the globe, dropping in on the field work of ornithologists and talking about bird behavior. Her new book is called The Bird Way. She stays with us for the hour. Jennifer, you know, let's talk about size behavior, but also the, you know, what type of behaviors that birds have. And you write that unusual behavior is often a sign of intelligence. How do you make that connection?
Well, unusual behavior is often innovative behavior. It's a bird doing something new to solve an old problem. And that is a very good indicator of intelligence. There's a scale of intelligence that was invented by an ornithologist in Canada named Louis Lefebvre. And he basically categorized bird families by their ability to do these sort of novel things. And it's often in different ways of foraging or, building their homes. Birds that innovate generally have bigger brains and they're just all around more intelligent.
Is it difficult to understand whether these are one-off anomalies or that these birds are actually doing these behaviors again and again?
Yes. There are some just one-offs. A bird does a really unusual thing and never does it again, or no other bird picks up on it. But birds are also very good at social learning. So if one bird figures out how to solve a problem, other members of its species, and sometimes even different species, will observe that behavior and imitate it. So these novel ways can easily spread in a bird population.
And there's a lot of mimicry going on as well in their cries and in their songs.
Yes, one of the really magnificent birds that I had the opportunity to listen to is the superb lyrebird of Australia, which is... it's a bird that just sings like no other bird. It has this incredible blend of its own calls and songs, and then dozens of these perfectly mimicked sounds, which are just these brilliant imitations of other bird voices in the forest.
And it can be like chainsaws. It can be like the sound of laser guns. I mean, it's crazy.
Yes, it was David Attenborough who made famous the lyrebird imitation of a chainsaw and also a camera shutter. But mostly they mimic the natural sounds. And when one of the scientists I went out with who studies lyrebirds in the Blue Mountains of Australia was telling me that one of the common sounds that she hears is a lyrebird imitating the creaking of trees as they blow in the wind, because she has a field site in a very windy area, and to hear a bird do a creaking tree is really just a marvelous thing.
What have lyrebirds done in captivity in zoos in Australia?
Well, they have mimicked human sounds. They often mimic what's around them, and so there have been some pretty funny stories about lyrebirds imitating the sounds of gates opening and that sort of thing. But they're called the mother of all songbirds because they have this incredible, resonant, beautiful voice, and they do these just crazy imitations. They can do whole flocks of parrots, and they can do, multiple kookaburras at the same time. It's astounding.
I wonder what they think they're accomplishing. Like, what is going on in that brain?
Well, so one of the theories is that lyrebirds mimic male lyrebirds mimic in order to impress females. So if you're very good at mimicry, it means you're a good learner and that you have a good brain. Now, both male and female lyrebirds mimic, but they mimic different kinds of calls. Like male lyrebirds tend to mimic all kinds of voices. Female lyrebirds tend to mimic more alarm calls, and they're the ones that protect their nests and raise their young, so they may be keeping away predators by mimicking alarm calls.
We're talking with Jennifer Ackerman, who is a science writer. Her new book is called The Bird Way. You can join in. Have you ever observed birds behaving intelligently? What did you see? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Debbie now, joining us from New Berlin. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. What are you seeing?
Well, every time this year, about 2 weeks ago, I started putting out grape jelly for the orioles passing through. And I would say maybe 7 days ago, they started just a feeding frenzy at my oriole feeder. And I've seen so many orioles in the past week. They fight over it. They're just so beautiful.
Well, I heard about the grape jelly, but also oranges, too. If you put out an orange half, does that work for you, Debbie?
I used to do that first. I would get a few here and there, but my next-door neighbor is the one that turned me on to the grape jelly. And, oh, my gosh, it's 100 times more attractive to them for some reason, probably the sugar.
Yeah. Do you have a question about robins?
Yeah, I also had a question about robins. I swear it looks like the same robin that nests on our patio every single year, probably for the past 5 years. I know this is probably a silly question, but I was wondering if robins do come back to nest in the same areas.
Debbie, thank you. Jennifer, not a silly question at all.
No, birds often return to if a nesting area has produced young for them. If they've had a successful nest there, they will nest there again. And some birds are extremely persistent about this. I spent time in the Delaware Bay area, and the osprey nesting there would often use power lines or telephone poles for their big nests of sticks. And the power company or the phone company would often take the nests down because they were interfering with the power lines or the phone lines. And the birds would just rebuild and rebuild and rebuild. It was amazing how loyal they were to a good nesting site.
How can we be good stewards for these Baltimore Orioles that are coming our way? Debbie's putting out grape jelly. What should we do?
Well, the main thing is, so it's okay to feed orioles and people often ask me about whether it's okay to feed hummingbirds sugar water. Birds need energy, so that quick energy from grape jelly or sugar water is okay. The main thing is to keep your feeding area clean. And if you can, to keep your food offerings nutritious. Birds, unfortunately, one of the most serious issues about feeding birds is the spread of disease. And if your feeding area becomes, messy and dirty and a bird is, comes in with an infectious disease, it can actually spread that disease. So you do need to keep your feeding, your feeders and your feeding areas clean.
And so when you wash those feeders or you refill those feeders, how often do you need to thoroughly cleanse them?
Well, if you're filling them constantly and there's a lot of turnover, generally I clean mine maybe every couple of weeks. And I'll soak it in some hot water and even put a little bit of and then let it dry out in the sun. I use a little bit of soapy water, the sun is a great disinfectant. So, if you let it dry in the sunshine and then refill it, you'll be in good shape.
What happens if squirrels get into your feeder? I often see squirrels figuring out a way.
They're also very clever. I have feeders that are called squirrel busters because they really, the squirrels just can't figure out how to get the food. They're on a spring and they're just, it's a very clever design. So I don't have squirrel trouble, but
you just wait.
Right.
dear. We're exploring bird behavior, learning from author Jennifer Ackerman that birds are far more intelligent than we give them credit for. Do you have questions about bird feathers or colors or patterns, what you're putting in your bird feeder, and what bird is coming to it? What do you think is the most visually striking bird? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation on the book The Bird Way with Jennifer Ackerman with more of your questions right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. We're spending the hour on bird behavior here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. That is a wood thrush, courtesy of the Cornell Lab. These birds appreciate the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest with its amazing canopy cover, and we're learning about the complexities of a bird's life, how they navigate the world, with your questions through the hour at 800-642-1234. We have author Jennifer Ackerman, who's been writing about science and nature for decades, and her new book is called The Bird Way, a new look at how birds talk, work, play, parent, and think. Jennifer, we heard from Dave from La Crosse, called in, wanted to give a shout out to the Kickapoo Valley Reserve's website where you can listen to bird songs. And Dave's favorite is the hermit thrush, and he calls it hauntingly beautiful. Where do you go for listening to bird songs?
Oh, you mean in the wild?
It could be in the wild. It can be online.
Yeah. There's a wonderful online source called Xeno Canto. X-E-N-O, Canto, and it has recordings from all over the world. Another favorite spot I go to is called Listening Earth, and it is the website of an Australian wildlife sound recording artist named Andrew Skiok, and he has beautiful bird calls and whole soundscapes on that website. As for listening to birds in the wild.
Yeah, when you're crisscrossing the world.
Yes, I listen wherever I go. And sometimes there are just such lovely surprises. I was in Sweden with a researcher who studies ravens and how they play. And one night in my hotel, while I was staying in Lund, Sweden, there was a blackbird singing outside my hotel window, and it was the most beautiful song. And, you know, it was just a simple blackbird, but it really moved me. And so you just never know where bird songs and calls will turn up. And you know, I'm always listening and appreciating.
I wonder if that bird's call would have been different if you had heard it in the United States or, you know, in your community somewhere. Is it just our ears hearing it differently, or is it the bird itself?
Well, I think there's, a little bit of both going on. This was a it was a quiet moment. It was sunset, and this bird was just singing its heart out. Now, it probably could have happened in the U.S. too, but it was just the circumstances. And, you know, there are really amazing bird calls and songs all over the world. When I was in Australia, I also heard the New Holland honey eater, which is a small bird, a little honey eater. And it has a call that is absolutely an alarm call that's packed with information. And this bird is really toppling our ideas about what's possible in bird communication, how much information they can convey.
Well, let's hear it first. So what are we getting there? What do you hear?
So when this bird spots a threat like a hawk, it lets loose with this alarm call. Now, it sounds simple, but when you analyze it, which the scientists have done, it's very complicated and it's packed with information. So this call is telling other birds in the area what kind of predator is coming, where it's arriving from, how far away it is, how fast it's flying, when to dive for cover, and even when it's safe to come out of hiding again. And what's really cool is that different species of birds understand in detail the honey eater's warning message, and they heed it. So it's kind of like birds can understand foreign languages.
It's like they're, you know, a first responder, and they're really, it's really packed with information.
Exactly. And it really makes you wonder what we're missing in other bird calls. You know, scientists are just beginning to parse the information in bird calls, and what they're finding is just fascinating.
Let's take another call now. Matt is with us from Sauk County. Hi, Matt.
Hi. So my question is, you know, the bluebirds have made a big comeback over the years because people have assisted by making nest boxes to replace the cavity, the natural cavities. Certainly the red-headed woodpecker is in decline, at least in some places. Is there any studies or any anybody looking into the possibility of, you know, replacing the natural cavity nesting sites with a nest box for redheaded woodpeckers? I know that it'd be complicated because it'd be higher off the ground, but is there anybody looking into that that you're aware of?
Gosh, I really don't know the answer to that. But I would imagine that there are conservation groups that are attempting just that. It's, you know, there really are, birds are very adaptable and they will use different kinds of sites that replace their natural sites. You know, another good example is the osprey that used to, you know, require on very, very big trees to support its nest, but it will nest on a man-made platform if one is supplied. And I think that this is true for cavity nesters as well. And certainly bluebirds have adapted in that way.
Matt, thank you for the call. We had another listener who emailed and said that they have a male cardinal that will sit on their dog kennel fencing and peck on the closed garage window where they enter their garage. And they noted that it seems to happen whenever the feeders are low, the sunflower seeds are in that corner of the garage. And it has that behavior repeated many times this year. Could that be what's going on, that they're saying, Hey, you're not doing your job, people. Feeder's low.
Yeah. You know, I've heard this again and again of birds actually knocking on the window for a feeder to be filled. And I don't know what to make of that, but it makes a certain amount of sense. Birds are very observant and they understand that, you know, that we're supplying food for them. So it's not a big leap to suggest that, you know, maybe they are actually urging us on in some way. The other thing about cardinals and windows and mirrors and things is that the cardinals are very territorial, and they will, you know, peck at their reflection if they see it in a mirror or window because they think it's a rival bird. So that could be possibly at play here, although it sounds more likely that the bird is actually asking for food.
Talking with Jennifer Ackerman, her new book is called The Bird Way, a new look at how birds talk, work, play, parent, and think. What observations are you making about birds in your community, in your backyard? Join in with your questions about birds, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. We heard from Matt in Madison, called in, couldn't stay with us. Matt says that they've started watching birds more often, and they thought birds would eat whatever is available, but we're surprised to learn that they are more selective about their food. Jennifer, how picky are birds about what they eat?
They are fairly picky. I mean, they have foods that they prefer over other foods. And right now, you know, a lot of birds are feeding their young, and birds are very selective about the foods that they feed their young at different stages of development. And you know, they will feed their young spiders, for instance, which are high in one certain kind of amino acid that's important in brain development, and then they'll move to another food source. So birds are being very, very picky about what they eat and what they feed their young this time of year.
Well, let's look at parenting. And there's a bird called the greater Ani that raises its babies kind of like a hippie commune style. Is that right?
Yes, this is a tropical bird, and it's common in the Amazon and its tributaries. And I just find this bird completely amazing. It's a cooperative breeder, and it gathers in groups of about a dozen birds, a dozen adults, to raise their young together. And unlike, you know, there are lots of birds that are cooperative breeders, but they're usually they breed in family groups, in relatives. And the Anis, their groups are completely unrelated. So they're basically raising their young with strangers, but they do it really expertly. They build a shared nest. They take turns warming the eggs and looking out for predators and feeding the young until they fledge. And, you know, one of the really interesting questions is, well, how do they coordinate all of these activities? And it turns out that they have these remarkable daily huddles. And it's actually several times a day. The birds gather in a tight circle and they point their bills inward. And then they begin to chorus in unison. And it's this weird, wonderful kind of bubbling, gurgling sound that starts to synchronize. And the scientists think that this kind of chorusing may actually be how the birds make decisions together. You know, where do we build the nest? Who's ready to lay eggs? You know, who's guarding the chicks tonight? And to my mind, it's just a remarkable example of avian ingenuity in achieving teamwork.
Wow. It's just like a board meeting with the birds. Let's bring in another call. Barb is with us from Grand Marsh. Hi, Barb. What are you seeing?
Hi, good morning, guys. I'm not seeing, hearing. I was on my porch at 5 in the morning this week, and I got to hear a whippoorwill.
Oh, and have you heard them before, or is this the first one?
Oh, I've heard them before, but usually at night, but I can't stay up late enough to hear them anymore. So I was really happy to hear it in the morning.
Oh, that is wonderful. Barb, thank you so much for calling in for the whippoorwill sound. The book is called The Bird Way. We have author Jennifer Ackerman, who's with us for the hour, explaining that, you know, we have a lot more in common with birds than we thought we do. They're capable of gathering together, sharing information, cooperating, communicating. Still time to talk about birds and hear what you're wondering about in your backyard at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with Jennifer Ackerman. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kahn. Thanks for being here. The book is called The Bird Way, and author Jennifer Ackerman stays with us. She's our guide. Let's take another call now. Wayne is here from Eau Claire. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning.
Good morning. What did you see?
Okay. Well, last year, about the same time, I was biking on a bike trail, and I noticed this bull, like, scurrying across the trail, and then this turtle came. And pecked at the bull and disoriented a little bit, picked it up and flew away. And I was like, wow, you don't see that every day. Mm-hmm. And so I asked some other people, and they were like, you didn't see that. And I was like, no, I know what I saw. So can you tell me about that?
Oh, Wayne, wow. So a cardinal chasing a bull, picking it up, flying away. Jennifer, is that possible?
You know, honestly, I think if you saw it, you saw it. And this is the thing about birds is that, you know, we make rules about them. And these birds are rule breakers. They do different things. They, you know, if that bird wanted a vole and chased it and, you know, possibly, who knows what it wanted to do with it. But I think it's absolutely possible. It goes back to what I was saying before about how birds, they really are innovators. They do new things. They break the rules that we assume about them all the time.
Let's go to Diane in Menasha. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to tell you about a couple things. Is as your show came on, I glanced out my kitchen window because I have those little 4-inch square deck feeders that I strap onto my deck railing. And here I had a rosebreasted grosbeak in one of my feeders. And I don't usually see them because, I don't know, for some reason they don't stay in my area, but I do see them once in a while as they're passing through. And this morning was just one of those days where I happened to catch it.
Wow.
So that was fun. And the other thing I just want to mention was that the previous caller had mentioned about birds getting our attention. Last summer, I heard a little tap on the glass of my my patio door, and my curtains were closed. And I just happened to peer out the glass to see if I had an injured bird. Maybe someone had rammed into the glass. And here there were about 12 mourning doves.
Oh, wow.
All looking at the door. They're all looking at me like, well, where's the food? Come on out.
Oh, I love that story. Diane, thank you so much for sharing with us. We also, Jennifer, had an email here wanting to know more about mourning doves and the purpose of their unique calls.
Yeah, they have those wonderful coos. And, you know, I think that those are probably, they're a you know, pretty social bird. Those are probably about, you know, letting each other know where they are. And this kind of social communication is very common in birds. And yeah, I just wanted to go back to Diane's experience with the rose-breasted grosbeak, because we've been seeing around my area in Virginia quite a number of these rose-breasted grosbeaks, and they're just so magnificently beautiful. And they really, it reminded me that of an elderly bird watcher I know. He described the effect of seeing a bluebird in his urban backyard during the lockdown. And he told me that it was, you know, the third time in 16 years that he had heard, that he had seen this bird in his yard. And he told me that the aura of the bird was much bigger than it's just, you know, the cold, hard fact of it. That, you know, a bluebird on his backyard fence is just a bird sitting on a piece of metal. But what it did to him was so much more. It was like the emotional and social and psychological uplift. You know, the bird was only there for a few minutes, but his day had completely changed. And people have told me this about the rose-breasted grosbeak, too. It's just such an uplifting experience to see this bird.
Birds have the power to move us in ways we don't expect. That is amazing. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
What a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Jennifer Ackerman's new book is called The Bird Way, a new look at how birds talk, work, play, parent, and think. And if you missed part of our conversation this hour, you can stream or download later today at WPR.org/mornings. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story of a Wisconsin musician.
Over the last few decades, some artists have been leaving the big city and making their way to Wisconsin's Driftless region. One of those people is musician Lou Shields. Bob Chirito brings us his story.
Musician and artist Lou Shields is much like the old school troubadours he sounds like. With his scraggly hair, work jeans held up by suspenders, and his trademark Dobbs hats, Shields looks like the embodiment of a 1930s character from a John Steinbeck novel. And his sound goes right along with that.
Here we go, not running on out today, but ain't nothing left that I could see. I'm heading on going over, don't on down, I'm heading on down now too. Ain't nothing left that I could do, I'm heading on down, I'm going on too. Ain't nothing left that I could do, I'm heading on out today. Well,
Shields never rolled the rails like a 1930s drifter, but he did travel extensively, ultimately finding a fitting home in the Driftless region of Wisconsin, where he and his wife live as homesteaders with their two daughters. Shields, a Chicago area native, discovered the area while researching old barns for another passion of his, drawing.
So I became obsessed with old farmhouses, old barns, and I began drawing them. And one of my series when I was traveling heavily was to kind of collect all these places before they were ultimately demolished, burned, you know, knocked down. And so I did a series of drawings where I was doing these barns and doing these farmhouses, and I kept getting more interested in the history behind it. And then I met my wife, and she was kind of doing the same thing with photography. And we began to together like really search these places out, and we found this little cabin out in the Driftless region of Wisconsin, 15 acres and a whole lot of wood piles all over the place.
Shields took that wood and lumber on his property and started building sheds in another cabin. Soon after, Shields discovered there were a lot of artists in the region.
Yeah, you know, when we first moved into that area, neither of us really had no idea, but the hills of the Driftless region is totally populated with a lot of different kind of folks. You know, some people just want to get away from the city. Some people that are, you know, interested in farming, organic farmers, things like that. And then a whole lot of artists and musicians.
Shields' music harkens back to a long gone time. He's a one-man band who plays a 1931 metal guitar, a banjo, and harmonica. He also plays percussion by standing on a homemade stomp box he made. He transports audiences to a time when folks would play music on their front porch after a hard day of work.
This guitar is really cool because it was actually sold through the Sears and Roebuck catalog, and they didn't put a logo on it, and they changed the cover plate a little bit. And they only did this with 600 of these guitars that one particular year. And so mine is super rare. It's kind of cool.
As for playing by himself, Shields says that's another homage to the past.
I really, a lot of the musicians from the early days, that's what they did. They couldn't afford to pay a band, you know, and have all these backing musicians until later. And I love the idea, like just the troubadour that they would go from place to place and make their music.
His most recent album, appropriately called Cabin Sessions, was recorded at his cabin using a vintage reel-to-reel recorder.
What I wanted to get was the natural sound of the interior of this place that's built out of all this old wood that you really can't find anymore, you know. So we just set up a real natural environment in trying to record the music and somehow get a really organic sounding recording of my songs, you know. Oh, yes, I'm running on
down back to the old river town. Lou Shields is a musician who splits his time in the Driftless region and Madison, Wisconsin, as well as Chicago. His story came to us from reporter Bob Chirito. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum. And this is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.